Well, I'm Bonnie Miller-McLemore, for those of you who are here for the first time. And this week, I'm having a great time trying to talk about, with you, and for my ideas, and here are some of yours, about how to practice faith in the midst of family life. And every session, I start with a sort of meditative reading that will then play in the backdrop from Scripture. And then I'll try to throw out some ideas and keep inviting you into conversation with me and with each other. But let me just say, it's interesting. I was saying that I went to the movie, which is next door on our footprint, and thought it's interesting that the practice, we're doing different practices each day, and sanctifying the ordinary was the first. Yesterday we talked about pondering or attending or paying attention. And today is doing justice. And it's interesting that they put it kind of next to this making a footprint, which is really about justice and the distribution of the world's resources. But it still makes sense to have doing justice on Wednesday, the middle of the week, with two practices, front end and two back end. Why? Because it really is the crux of, and the test, and the hardest family Christian practice, and I'm going to say more about that. And I think when I think of justice, I think of just love, not just justice as a dry, ethical, do good. So I'm going to talk a bit more about that. I'm going to start with two scriptures. Micah 6:8. These are going to seem real familiar to you. And then going to the New Testament, Matthew 25, again, a scripture that I think when you hear it, it kind of maybe haunts. These are haunting scriptures, they are for me at times. And I'm going to start with Micah 6:8. I'm going to start a few verses ahead of this because it really sets the tone for Micah 6:8. You hear the prophet Micah just asking, "What shall I come before the Lord and bow myself before God on high? Shall I come before God with burnt offerings, with calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, with 10,000s of rivers of oil?" And then he goes to the ultimate. "Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my own body for the sin of my soul? But God has told you, O mortal, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you? But to do justice, to love kindness, and to walk humbly with your God." Easy. just that, you know. Wouldn't it be nice if we could give rams and burnt offerings and be done with it?
We did 10%.
Say?
We did 10%.
Tithing. Took me a while.
A lot of people look at it that way.
And then feel as if they're done.
That's it.
Let's go to Matthew. And this is a long, bear with me, because this is a long passage, but I think it's worth hearing it all the way through. "When the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him, then he will sit on the throne of glory. And all the nations will be gathered before God, and God will separate people one from another as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. And God will put the sheep at God's right hand and the goats at the left. And then the king will say to those at his right hand, 'Come, you who are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. I was naked, and you gave me clothing. I was sick, and you took care of me. I was in prison and you visited me. And then the righteous will answer him, Lord, when was it that we saw you hungry and gave you food, or thirsty and gave you something to drink? And when was it that we saw you a stranger and welcomed you, or naked and gave you clothing? And when was it that we saw you sick or in prison and visited you? And the king will answer them, truly I tell you, just as you did it to one of the least of these who are members of my family, you did it to me. And then he will say to those at his left hand, I'm struck as I read this to just pause for a second. And for those of you who have been going to the Bible study, the very first day she talked about parallelism and repetition in the Psalms. And here, you know, the repetition is incredible, that you hear all of these repeated back, and then you're going to hear it again, because here we go again. You know, then he turned to those at his left hand, you are accursed, departed from me into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and you gave me no food. I was thirsty, and you gave me nothing to drink. I was a stranger, and you did not welcome me. Naked, and you did not give me clothing. Sick and in prison, and you did not visit me. And then they will answer, Lord, when was it that we saw you hungry or thirsty or a stranger or naked or sick or in prison and did not take care of you? And then he will answer them, truly I tell you, just as you did not do it to one of the least of these, you will not do it to me. You did not do it to me. And these will go away into eternal punishment, but the righteous into eternal life. Woo! Yeah, how do you feel when you finish this passage? I mean, how does it, especially those of you, let's put this back to you, those of you immersed in the immediacy of caring for young children, or old, or middle age, or...
I was so humbled by that passage. Like, I think I'm doing a good job, and then I read that passage, and I'm like, wait a minute, am I really doing a good job? And then am I teaching my kids what it means to do that? Mm-hmm. And I feel kind of small, really small.
Yeah. High demand passage. Other, just hearing it, I'm struck in reading it that it's so linked to salvation and eternal damnation. It's a passage that it's the sheep and the goats.
There's a great story that Millard Fuller, who started Habitat for Humanity, tells or told. Did he die? I think he died recently. Just when he was starting Habitat and needing to raise money, he was going mostly to men's prayer breakfasts in the South, because I think he was from Atlanta and he was maybe in North Carolina. He had a series of these weekends he'd go out and talk to these men's prayer breakfasts. And he was not getting much juice back from these guys. And he knew he needed a different tack. And he looks at him and says, if you don't give money to this, you're all going to go to hell. And I thought, oh, this is where he got this, of course. And he said, you know, that probably wasn't the most elegant way to raise money, although that's really when it kicked off, because he realized what was at stake with what he was doing. It wasn't just good works. It was something much more profound than that. But we usually stop after the goat or the sheep part. We like to identify with the sheep, and we may convict ourselves that we don't do it very well, but we don't go to, they will be thrown into the lake of fire for the devil and all his angels. Like, wow, that's rough company.
Yeah, but both camps, what struck me is that both camps mm-hmm. don't understand what they have done or not done. And so that tells me that we go along our way doing our thing and not knowing which camp we're in until the question is posed. When you just aren't consciously thinking about it.
That I think that'll point us ahead, because that points us back to yesterday where we talked about paying attention mm-hmm. that we may not know, but looking for opportunities in the mundane to practice our faith and recognize when we may be embodying these. So you're kind of pointing us forward, mm-hmm. but yeah.
I was thinking it's very similar. Mundane is, to me, it's a very where the rubber meets the road kind of passage.
Yeah.
And it's taking the sights from something lofty and otherworldly right back down to where we are and what's around us.
Yeah.
It's a call to pay attention to yeah. what is immediate.
Yeah. So humbling, what were some of the other when you hear these?
One of the things I was going to say is before having kids, I was really active in social justice issues. And then having kids, I'm like, I don't have time. I'm dealing with diapers. I'm dealing with driving someone to school. I'm dealing with grocery shopping. And so then I feel like I don't like that because that's not really how I want to spend my days, you know, but that's how I have to. And so it's dealing with diapers. You know, I think there's a bigger world out there that I want to teach my kids about. It's not just about what goes on in our family.
So,
but I think it's important to take those things that you do every day and show your kids that you do that in, to honor God, you know, to take those everyday mundane things and turn them into something special, make them appreciate that and be able to take that outside of the house, is what I think.
Well, too, because the least of these are the children. And if we forget that part of our job is taking care of the least of those that are assigned to us for that short amount of time, then we've overlooked, too, what Jesus is asking us to do.
Oh, you're getting way ahead of me. That's right where we're going to go. I mean, we might want to stick or come back to why is doing justice such a high demand, hard thing in the midst of family life? Why is this core Christian practice made more difficult by family? But I think you've pointed us to, really what I think we want to do is talk about the problem and then talk about what are some ways we can do this? And you've already, that's really one of the very first ways we can do this, is recognize that the hungry are the children, that the non-clothed are your kids. Imprisoned, well, I don't know. They may feel that way. my third son did. He never wanted to sleep. And he'd get up in his crib, get me out of here, you know. And I was, you know, I guess when I said haunting, I sometimes as a parent would hear the Matthew passage and just feel like, you know, just, I'm not doing it. I'm not doing it anymore.
Yeah.
And so it was, I mean, I think you've pointed us to, I couldn't believe when I came across Martin Luther's words again. I think I said there's a section earlier in this book, what a friend I have in Luther. I'm not Lutheran, by the way. But finding his words, I write, after years of listening to Matthew 25 with self-reproach because I have not made it out of the home to somewhere else, prison, hospital, homeless shelter, food pantry, Luther's words were welcome. He writes, how many good works you have at hand in your own home with your child who needs all such things as these, like a hungry, thirsty, naked, poor, in prison sick soul. And again, I was saying earlier in the week, he was a turning point, or he retrieved a stream already existing in the Catholic tradition as a really deeply committed Catholic. And christened parents, these were his words too, he christened them apostles, bishops, and priests to their children. And in fact, a later historian in the Lutheran tradition puts it that the family, the adult who engages in Christian nurture of children is carrying out, quote, a far better work in God's sight than all the current pilgrimage sacrifices and cultic ceremonies combined. I like that echo back to Micah, you know, that you are trying to do this in the midst of the fullness of family life. And another quote from Simone Weil in the same sort of, it sounds like it echoes Luther, and maybe goes back to talking about paying attention. A quarter of an hour of attention is better than a great many good works. You know, and I was thinking, watching a father today who's going to go outside with a young two-year-old and attend to the child, and to do that with focus and presence, instead of, you know, I really need to be doing something else, and this, I'm just putting in time till I can really get back to my real life. And, you know, and to say, it's a great work, a good work. But let's go back to why it's so hard. Why is it hard besides time? What else about family life makes love of others outside your family?
Sad.
Well, I feel drained after the day. Mm-hmm. I'm just
no more to give.
Especially bringing up my oldest. She was a clean baby, and I mean, I at least could put him down. I could not put him down. And so by the end of the day, I was just like, don't come near me, don't touch me, don't talk to me. How about you just hold her for a while and leave?
Yeah. Well, it's a for young kids, it's a one-way interaction, emotionally and physically. You're taking care of them, they're giving, and it's relentless.
Yeah.
It's 24/7.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah. You know, 2 o'clock in the morning, yeah. 4 o'clock in the morning, yeah, 6 o'clock in the morning.
And in, you know, 2 weeks into it, you're going, I'm tired, and you're like, oh my God.
18, yeah.
Right, 18 more years?
They never go home.
There's a gap of expectation. Where do I get something from the back line?
Right.
And when that first time that child looks at you and smiles back, there's something back. And that's great. But it isn't all that we frail humans need, frankly.
Yeah.
I think it's hard also because everything that you do in making a home, at least this is how I felt when I was home with my children when they were small, is everything is redundant, monotonous, and everything I accomplish is immediately undone. Whatever I clean is immediately made dirty. Whatever laundry I do is immediately, you know, soiled. Whatever dish I wash is immediately, you know, the kitchen is a disaster within 10 minutes. You know, every meal that I make.
You cook, they eat it.
First, they complain about it, and then it's gone.
Yeah.
There's very little sense of accomplishment because the to-do list just ramps back up again.
And it feels like what I do is never enough because of that relentless quality, more, 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 said the baby.
Yeah.
You know, and that aspect of parenting for me has not gone away, even though my kids are now 10, 12, and 14, because I cannot do enough. I can do one brilliant thing in this at 2 o'clock, and at 2:05, my daughter's asking for something else, something more.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that aspect of it, you know, exhausting. It's hard for me to figure out where the healthy boundary is for her and for me to be attentively present, but then also to encourage her to be an independent person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I recently ran into a friend of a friend who has 5 little twins, and we were talking about the, you know, having one-on-one time with your kid and how much that helps to grow the relationship, and it, you know, helps to get through so much of the tough times. And he said, yeah, my new rule is, I know I'm having a good day as a dad if I get absolutely nothing accomplished. He said, if I actually get something done, then I probably wasn't a good dad that day. Just a little extreme, but you definitely have times when you feel like that, when, you know, if you're trying to do the dishes, then you're ignoring the kids, and then it doesn't feel like you're being the parent you want to be, but the dishes are still there, the laundry's still there, the food needs to be bought and prepared.
You know, it occurs to me, though, that I can look to, like, Holden itself as a community as an example of that. And, like, today, you know, they're like, there's this ton and a half of food, whatever, there's a lot of food that's coming up. We say, hey, we need some help, bring it in. And, you know, I think there's a model there for our kids. Say, hey, we got some work to do here, and we got to do some work together. And then, you know, because I think when we're put in a position of always doing the work, I don't have that strength. I don't know. You know, I think we can't engage them in that. But it's a community.
friends.
And not in bottles. And I think a lot of us, you know, white, well-educated liberals go into parenting thinking it's a democracy, and you're in trouble.
Yeah.
In trouble until you figure out it isn't.
No, yeah.
And
you have a vote, but I have five more.
Yeah. We have work we need to do.
Yeah.
Now, is it better, I mean, think it'd be, because is it better to do it in the morning or in the afternoon? But we have work that we have to do.
Exactly.
I think in the book a metaphor, a story that illustrated that so perfectly. We have a dining room or kitchen table with, it's round, which I like because in a way it gets rid of the head of the table, and it does embody in some ways what I want to have happen is a pretty fluid relational interchange between parents and children. But one day, one of my kids, I have three boys, I haven't said this again to, and when I started some of this thinking, they were...
You have four boys?
Three. Well, if you include my husband, four. but, you know, they're now 18, 20, and 23, but I've been thinking about these issues since they were really little. Mm-hmm. And at this point, I don't know how old the one that asked us, but it seems like it was kind of elementary age, and he said, how come you and Dad get the chairs with the arms? Because there are just two chairs with the arms, and it was exactly what you said. We had a conversation that came out of that question that, you know, that said, on the one hand, we really do see you as emerging, responsible, full participants in this family. But finally, at some point, we get the chair with the arms, you know, for a certain period of time. And it was a way in which we could talk about both the democracy and the sense of responsibility and authority that we still hope to have over their lives. But I think we'll come back to this, because this is one of the pieces of how do you practice justice, you know, once we talk. Let me just summarize what I hear about are some of the problems that I hear you all saying. One, I thought right at the beginning, another way to say it is this feeling of love's finitude. Love's finitude, it's finite. You can only give, you know, you can only give so much. I thought both of you were really saying that, and after a while you need to receive. Mm-hmm. And you need support in giving. And in some ways, we're also saying that you really love those that are proximate to you. Your immediate family, and those that really do need your care. I also heard you say that kind of love, it's so ordinary, it's so mundane, it's so repetitive, it's so always unending, and it doesn't feel like you're doing justice. You know, even though Luther can say that caring and clothing, feeding, is an honorable task of priestly merit, it doesn't feel that way. It doesn't look that way compared to maybe the kind of accomplishment you would see or feel in some other act of doing good. It gets lost. I think that we've said enough about, let me also say a bit more about this being at the heart of the Christian spiritual tradition for families. I would say that I've said earlier in the week that if you went into the bookstore and looked for a spiritual self-help for the family, my guess is that very few books will have a chapter on doing justice. That most of those books are about, I looked at some of them, and I'm thinking, let me see how I describe them. Feeling good inside. This was on the back of one book that was called Raising Spiritual Children in a Material World. Looks like a good book. We'd all want to buy it. But this is someone who's spiritual but not religious. And has really, in my view, sometimes when you're spiritual and not religious, it's an easy way to drop out the real hard demands of the Jewish and Christian tradition. And so I invite you to look at that book or others. This is on the back cover. Feel good inside no matter what happens outside. I mean, one of the entries in the book is, or one of the chapter titles is Entries from a Spiritual Shopper's Journal. How to find the church that best, the goal is, you know, finding the church that best.
Shopping for a church, not going to the store and spiritually shopping at Nordstrom.
And maybe this is an unfair, exaggerated stereotype, but I think, you've got the...
Well, that's really ironic if the whole point is against the material world and there could be a consumer attitude towards spirituality. I mean, that's a complete irony.
But you can see why, when I read both of these, the Jewish text and the Christian text, what high demand that is to lead a genuinely, richly Christian spiritual life, and how that might be the first piece that you would drop out. Because the challenge is so deep. I tell my own story in this, just one paradigmatic piece of my own story, and I also tell a story of a family that both of the stories are about where do you live when you choose to move or when you raise a family. I think it's also true, where do you send your kids to school? Which church do you go to in what neighborhood? These questions are pervasive. The story I tell for myself is that I wasn't acutely aware that that was a huge choice about justice and doing good, that all of my values and commitments became apparent in those major choices, and how to discern the best choice amidst all the competing goods and needs in making a move in neighborhood and where to live. And the family, the story that I tell is that I found another minister, or maybe he's not a minister, another man and in a family context who chooses to move with his children into a very poor neighborhood into Detroit. And he talks about, what made me think about his story is he talks about when he baptizes his children and when he had stood there and listened to what the Christian faith life is a commitment to, it was again not, it was to promise his children into the life of bearing the cross. Does he realize what you're doing when you baptize children into the Christian faith? Again, a reminder of the demand of how hard these demands are. So that's enough on how hard. unless you have other experience. I think one thing we didn't hear is maybe other, for those of you who have teenagers or those of you who have thought about where do you send your kids to school, where do you live, you've faced some of these decisions in your own choices probably already. Any other things about the difficulties before we go to what do we do?
I think that there's a challenge when you think about that. I think it's a big transition to go from a life of taking care of your own commitment to doing justice and then starting a family and realizing that there's a certain upheaval in the rhythms of your life until you're maybe ready to consider how you start, how you incorporate that value into the practice with however many of you, first there's the marriage and how you, a partnership, a commitment, and how you practice these values together. And I think that it really does take a certain period of time of only having energy to establish this new unit, and then there comes a time when it starts to build back into itself, or it comes in seasons too. I guess one of the things that came to mind as we were talking about this is I have I've taken steps back from certain volunteer commitments I've had in a social justice kind of arena. But just a couple of weeks ago, I got a call from the group of people that I volunteer with that somebody needed a ride to the hospital for an appointment. I committed to it 2 weeks before, knowing, okay, I can't forget this because I'm going to have the kids and having one of that. I finally said to them, I said, kids, we can't do anything else until we take this person to the hospital. And just loaded them in the car because I thought, do I take the child care? I thought, nope, we're all going to do it together. We're going to go. We're going to go pick him up. And they know kind of about this group of people. And we were saying, well, why does he need to go to the hospital? So we talk about why he needs to go to the hospital. And then, well, why do we have to drive him? And then there's a conversation about why we have to drive him. And the whole period, the whole thing didn't take a whole lot of time. I mean, it took some time. But, and maybe in the grand scale of how we do justice in the world, it wasn't a big thing, but it was a thing. And
I think it's a big thing, actually. I think it was a big thing.
Maybe it was, but it was an opportunity to include the kids in a way that I wasn't even going to try to decide how they were going to relate to it. That wasn't for me to do, but it was something we could all do together. And I think that social justice, there's a lot of justice to be done in the world, but we're all going to enter into it in the way we can at the time, you know, at that time in our life.
Did you want to say more, or just emphasize?
Well, I was really, had this intense desire to be at hospice and to volunteer, and my work situation was such that I could do that for really like the first time in a long time. I could do it on a weekly basis. So I went through the training and started volunteering at hospice, but one of my children has a great need. And I thought, well, you know, I'll do it when she's at school and it'll be just fine. And it came, I think I volunteered about 4 or 5 months maybe, and it came to the point where I had to release it. And I was just so sad to release it because I thought, you know, I finally have this chance to do something. But I think the point is that you made that I just need to find things that we can do together.
Yes.
Yeah. I just wanted to speak to that because my wife and I were on an AIDS care team, and the way this worked out is that there was a group of maybe 8 people that came around, someone that had AIDS, and we just spent time in a relationship with this individual. And then we had our kids, and it was like, you know, you're struggling and you're trying to do a diapers and you're doing all the stuff you do. Mm-hmm. And we were just absolutely stretched, and we're like, no, we can't do this. And then we talked to this individual. We said, well, what we can offer is you participating in that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And in our life, in right. that way. You can come over, have a meal, and you can help mm-hmm. us bathe the kids and you know that.
Right.
And he was like, sure, I love that.
Yeah.
And it's been great, and he's been a part of our family for 10 years now.
Wow.
But I think that, you know, not, you know, we kind of create this wall. We do mission work, and it's mm-hmm. kind of out there, mm-hmm. and we make it a part of our family. Mm-hmm. It's fun anyway.
Okay.
Something that I've found is our kids got probably 4 and 5 years old, and then now as they're getting into their teenage years, is they ask lots of questions. We'll be driving through a really dilapidated neighborhood in St. Louis, and you know that windows are broken and the houses are boarded up, and they'll see, you know, street people and ask questions. And so we've used that a lot to engage our kids. So why is that? Why do people, you know, are they lazy? No. And so we talk through. So they've sort of they're developing this socioeconomic matrix of understanding the world. And the oldest one will go toe-to-toe with anybody on, you know, single-payer universal health care. Partly because when he was 4 and 5, why is the world this way? And it's often, why is it this person I know? There will be a child at school, in our school district, they bus in kids from the city as part of a desegregation program. And a lot of the African-American kids in our district, which is mostly all white district, need more remedial help. And so why is that? And so we have lots of opportunity to talk about stereotypes, about you know, the kinds of, not just families people grow up in, but the way the culture shapes that. And there's also times where you can, like, the bring the kids along to pick up somebody. It's not always the ideal situation. Mm-hmm. But at my church, we had an event called the Shower of Stoles, which is this very powerful ministry of these two women have collected a couple thousands, 4,000 or 5,000 stoles commemorating gay and lesbian persons who have not been able to serve in the church. Yeah. Or who are serving in the closet, and some who are serving out, and they'll send you the whole, like, about 1,000 stoles, and each one has a story. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't, we had to, you know, again, the family took over, and when they were setting it up, I couldn't be there. But for the takedown, I could, and I thought, they can tag along with me, at least they can fold them and place them in the box. And the oldest one was able to read all of them, and so there's this, they have this consciousness. In part, just, you know, as your kids are going to have by bringing them along to the hospital. Why does this person need to go to the hospital? Yeah. Or the friend who's got HIV/AIDS, you know, they can't understand everything, but they understand compassion and stories.
Let me just summarize what I am saying. We've talked about honoring the giving already happening in the mundane, in your own family, as sanctioned, but not stopping there. I mean, that would be idolatry of the family. But I think Luther was right to correct the tradition's interpretation that you have to go somewhere else. It's only when you get out of your house. I think he was really right to say it begins there. But the second thing I really hear you saying, or a second thing about doing justice, is incorporating and modeling it so that you're embodying it, and the family then becomes a training ground. Or there's interesting, when I was doing the research on this, I'd run across metaphors that people would use for, let's see if I can give you one that you're using, a bridge, a mission field. And I use the metaphor from the Jewish tradition of the mezuzah, is that the right name, that's on the doorway. And I this may not be how the Jewish tradition interprets it, but I understand that as a constant reminder when you go in and out, that love internal to the family is not sufficient to what God expects and asks of us. So I think you've moved to the second place of doing justice, which is practicing it with your children. It's interesting, the social science studies, Robert Withnow, who's a sociologist of religion, has sort of documented, and it's, you know, you can always take or leave statistics, but that children are informed about faith as much by watching you.
Mm-hmm. Seeing, much more.
Yeah.
Seeing you read scripture may be as important as having scripture read to them. So I think in some ways, I loved your raising up Holden as a good example, because it is intergenerational mission together. They can participate in, they can see you in the trip, you know, they can bringing food in, and they can, you know, join in with some of the work that supports the community. And I think sometimes churches, because we have sometimes been so age segregated, only adults go on this mission trip, or only adults are allowed in the Habitat for Humanity site. And I think sometimes that does rob us of opportunities of fuller intergenerational participating in doing justice.
There was a family here earlier this week, and she had taken her two young boys down to Mexico for Habitat, and they'd been building this house, and the kids, you know, it's what, 6 and 8 or something, yeah. Yeah, at the time, were in there beating nails or whatever they were doing, helping out one of them, and came to a point where they're like, you know, really got to get some work done, and then they went and they played out in the street with the kids, and that was also a learning exercise as well.
And I was going to just say, we can also shift to, I heard a third kind of thing of doing justice and thinking about justice internally to the family and mundane conversations around issues that crop up. But go ahead. Will you?
I was going to say that our church actually, especially in recent years, has done a really good job of, number one, presenting opportunities for me to sign up. We serve a meal at a homeless shelter once a month, but it's not the same people always doing it. So there's an opportunity, and we brought our daughter in the backpack and served meals before. And we now serve a meal at our church once a month, and we have a back-to-school giveaway. And my daughter is just turning 6 and is so excited about when she gets to be, you know, some of these things she can be involved with, and some of them she needs to be 8 or 10 to do. But it's they've done a really good job of providing those opportunities so that if you aren't able to do, you know, every Thursday Meals on Wheels or something like that, there are still opportunities for you to be involved in doing justice.
I'd love to share a story, and I'm afraid I'm not going to do it justice. So we attend a very, very small church. There's maybe 20 people in the congregation on Sunday, adults. There are sometimes 14 kids in the church, so it's a very unique congregation. And for the last few years, we, from kind of through the Lenten season up through Pentecost, we do Pennies for Peace. Does anyone not know what Pennies for Peace is? So it's Greg Mortensen, who was a person who had an experience in Afghanistan and Pakistan, established a foundation for schools in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And a penny will buy a pencil in Pakistan. And this is something that kids can relate to, and so it's a collecting pennies. And so they'll do it, and there's a preschool there, and my daughter's school does it. And so one of the elders, a mother, talked about how she'd gotten the story, Three Cups of Tea. There's a children's or a young adult version, and she'd gotten this and given it. She thought maybe her daughter Hannah would want to read it, and didn't hear anything about it. But somewhere along the line, she heard that her daughter was, you know, there was a book group at the school, and they were, that the book group was getting together, and Hannah wanted to go to it, and they were reading Three Cups of Tea, and the way she tells it is wonderful. But what ended up happening was that her daughter didn't sound like she was interested in it, but she actually took the book to school, showed some friends of hers the book. She's the one that organized the book group. And she's the one that talked to the teacher about how maybe some other kids would enjoy reading this book. And because of what she saw the church doing, she kind of took it upon herself to go and really introduce this to her friends and to her school. And this was something that her mom kind of found out about really at the end of this all happening. But it was really a very tangible example to the congregation of how something that is simply presented as an opportunity, kids can really, they're pretty good at connecting the dots and taking the initiative. So it was a wonderful example of sort of like inviting kids to eat vegetables. At some point they will like it.
And what I'm also hearing a little bit is, you know, the exponential multiplying of, you know, if you're busy with a family, but you have one or two or three children, and you teach them the spiritual value of the practice of doing justice, you've done a lot. Mm-hmm. That they will, when they have the responsibility, capacity, as they continue to grow, it multiplies what, you know, your efforts of raising them are doing. So that seems to point to that. Let's go back to this. I think the other thing that you do in a family context is there are so many mundane opportunities to talk about and reframe poverty, racism, injustice around the issues that just surface. I too found that my kids are in a school that's fairly integrated, and there were times when I really felt we had to talk about why racism was a cause for strife in the school, or for something that happened that emerged out of poverty and lack, and to set a broader framework and to spend a moment, you know, if you can catch it, over the dinner table, or in front of the television when you can interpret what's being sold here in this advertisement? Is that a just use of women's bodies to sell cars or beer? So there are mundane opportunities to, you know, really bring questions of justice. So we've talked about two areas, at least, if not more, the sort of seeing the family itself as a place of practice and honor and respecting that, teaching and modeling doing justice. But I want to go back to a comment right at the beginning. You may not have been saying this, but you said just getting the relationship, the marriage, working. What were you meaning when you said that? Because I think that's a third place. You may not be, were you?
Well, I guess I speak as someone who got married on the later side of still wanting to have a family. And I think that as we go, I mean, and I'd say this is true at any time one enters into a committed relationship. You go from hopefully being at some stage in your adult life and having it kind of assumed your independence and your sense of values to not losing those, but definitely integrating them with another independent person and probably shared values, but a different manifestation of that, and either complementary or contradictory personalities or gifts, and I think it really takes a lot, even if your values are identified as identical, to blend how you express those values into either a teamwork in working toward those values or some sense of interworking as maybe you do it differently if your gifts send you in different ways of expressing those. And I think that takes time. And we went right from getting married to starting a family pretty quickly. And those are two different integrations.
Mm-hmm. Or in some cases, you already have, you know, Karen here,
or
you already have the children.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And there is no time to just be a couple without children.
And partly what I'm hearing and what I want to add or say is that the family itself has to do justice internal to the labor and distribution of the work of the family. That is, and in fact, some, and this is a woman in political science who argues this, that justice model internal to the family will help foster justice in the wider context. Injustice internal to the family will replicate injustice. It's the school for learning fair distribution of resources and labor. And that is tough.
And I think it's a fair discussion, and maybe not fully out in front of children, but I think that children, there's a learning process, and this is a kind of an adaptation of a different way, but as you talk about, like within your family, of there's only so many hours of the day, and we have this much work to do, and there's all this work out in the world to do. How do we balance all that? Or
that children should be involved too.
Should be able to hear,
yes,
that, because it will be a lifelong struggle to balance those things, and there really are times when your work is within the family, so that you can be stronger to do justice out in the world when it's the right time.
So I think you have at least two complicated things going on there. You have the adults in the family having to determine what's a fair distribution of the labor. I mean, we had a myth that kind of ran and peaked in the 1950s that work was what you got paid for and the home was not work. And so we're talking, the home is a huge amount of work, and how do you distribute that labor between two adults? And that's tough, depending on where you enter the relationship, when you enter, what values you both brought into the relationship, what the gifts are, that you, what do you do better, what of the mundane, laborious, never, you know, always relentless, you know, that was maybe one of, and that task can sometimes come and be resolved way before children. Sometimes you don't have time to resolve it before children. And I think that is...
But then children also bring up, you know, all then, sorts of other needs.
And then children bring a whole more new layer of labor. So we have that. That's number one. And I think it is an ongoing and very difficult issue. I would say for myself, we are always somehow readjusting what seems to be a just love. I mean, I would hate to say that this is equal. We're not talking tit for tat. We're talking that there's love at the core, but there also needs to be justice in the labor. But the second thing we're touching on is, then how do you bring children into that and invite them to be participants? And I will say that I thought that became harder the older my kids became.
Is there a question underneath what you're touching on here around prioritization of where your attention is, whether it's with your spouse or with your kids? And I think kids, they want that primary attention. And I think there's that tension between the couple as well, whether it's with the kid or whether it's with the spouse.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's another real struggle. It is for us anyway. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're, yeah.
We have to go back right at the core and be kind of honest with ourselves, I think, too, about our own needs for career or ambition or, well, that's tough stuff. I would love to do a study on ambition. My husband and I worked it out. It would just seem, it didn't seem hard, it just seemed obvious that I did a graduate degree in something that makes more money than he did, so he stayed home with the kids. Now, if he were here, he'd remind me he had to work through some stuff. He was better at home with the kids than I would have been. But it just kind of worked out. And then I was just so excited to get home to them. And I guess early on, I didn't like my career that much that I thought it would be fun to go to a free dinner by a drug rep rather than come home and eat with my kids. So I guess those were some choices and it worked out pretty well.
What I hear you reminding us is that justice isn't a flat equality of sameness.
Right.
That's what really tests and pushes us, that justice is much more complex than that. Taking in multiple factors, including this factor. I think on Monday someone used that wonderful word for gift, charism, that we have different gifts that we bring into the family, and so determining what is fair is a complex question. It's not we both need to bring in the equal amount of income, or we both get to work the equal number of hours outside the house, or we need to just take the chores and split them equally. There needs to be equality, but it has to be, it's a complex way in which it can be embodied.
Well, and not only between the two spouses, but with children. Like my parents expected something totally different of me grade-wise than they did of my sister. Mm-hmm. The same ways of, you know, that kind of stuff, just because that's who we were, and it wasn't based upon, you know, you must get A's because your sister gets A's, or you must get, you know, you must do this because your sister does this, and you have to keep your room clean, or, you know, that kind of stuff. I mean, they expected me to do, before I would leave for, you know, to go out on Friday night, I had to have my room clean, but I didn't have to have it clean all the rest of the week, is a thing. And whereas my sister just kept hers clean. That's just how things were. And that's, but they didn't say, because
they didn't make you come to her standard.
Right. They didn't make us be the same person, and they didn't make it fair being straight across the board.
Fair and equal are different.
They're different.
Realities.
And I'm hearing echoes of Micah. What's beautiful about Micah is it's a threefold litany of doing justice. If you just stopped there, Micah said that's all you have to do is do justice. But no, do justice, loving kindness. I think what I hear you saying is that your parents were able to bring kindness, or in your example too, and then walking humbly, really being humbled by the impossibilities of just cut and dry justice, equality, fairness. that that may never happen, given it's not the eschaton yet.
I feel like we sort of jump from, you know, pre-kid being able to do kind of whatever we decide is appropriate for us to, you know, we have to start with teaching our children they're not the center of the universe, you know. And that's a really tough thing to teach, because you want your kids, I mean, you want your kids to think they are that they are your world, you know. And so you have to lovingly teach them that they're not the center of the universe, and that it pulls at our heartstrings to do that, because, you know, we want them to know that they're unconditionally loved, but we have to show them that they're not the only one who's unconditionally loved. You know? So, you know, you have to show them from the, I think as soon as you, you know, can, that, you know, mommy needs time and daddy needs time and you need time, you know. I mean, my kids have always had rest time from the beginning. You know, we don't call it nap time, it's rest time. You have your time, I have my time. You know, I stayed home with my kids. I've stayed home with them for 10 years, and, you know, they know mommy goes to Bible study. You go to childcare, mommy has Bible study time, and I think it's been important to show them that that's important to me, and that not everything, I'm not going to let a bunch of things stand in my way of that type of thing, you know. And, you know, it's a challenge, always, but my kids, that was just something I didn't want them to think that they were always the center of everything.
Yeah.
And the choices that they made were for them, you know, and I wasn't going to let their bad choice of, you know, whatever, affect the whole entire house.
Yeah.
In such a way that it broke it down, you know.
Yeah.
I think that's a really important reframing of self-care as an act of justice,
mm-hmm.
As opposed to the prerequisite so we can then do justice. You know, I have to be healthy, or I have to be centered, I have to take care of myself. That is a form, perhaps the primary form of justice is self-care.
For just love.
And
yeah.
Because if you're not healthy, you can't love people justly. You can only love them out of need, either the need to be loved or the need to be needed. It's the same two sides of the same coin. So that's, I think that's really important.
I read a parenting book called Scream Free Parenting by Hal Runkle, and he really is, it's not a discipline book, you know. I mean, it kind of sounds like it's going to be, but it has nothing to do with it. He gives you no, like, okay, when your kid does X, you should do Y. You know, it's about, it continually comes back on, what are you doing about you,
mm-hmm.
you know. And it's like, you want your kids to clean your room, go clean your own. You know, set the example. Don't go bother them. It's their space, let them do it. You want, you know, you want the kitchen clean, go clean the kitchen, and, you know, inspire them to help you, you know, make it fun or whatever. But, you know, an hour of time with your kids and you're grumpy is useless, you know. If you can take 15 minutes for yourself and then have 45 minutes of great time with your kids, you know, that's fabulous. And it's not always easy to find that time, but you have to, you know. And it took me a while to find my time. My time's 5:30 in the morning when I go work out. People think I'm absolutely insane. But I learned I have got to get up before the rest of the house. I have to, or I'm not a good mom. I'm not good for the house if I don't get up before everybody else. Saturday, Sunday, it does not matter what it is. And it's worth it to me to get up at that time, because I know I'm that much, I cannot stand getting woke up by the kids. Like, it just sets me off. It makes me so mad that I didn't get to choose when to get up. It's, you know, it's about choice, but. And my kids know that now, they're old enough. Like, but I'm always up before the rest of the house. I have to be. Even here, it's like, it's innate now to get up before everybody else, or at least to be awake. But
excuse me.
No, I didn't have anything else.
It's two things. I love how things fit together. I'm doing some work on learning about Sabbath and what it's meaning of Sabbath. And he starts with a description of many of our lives. So busy, 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 going, going, going. And stops the reader short when he said that's a violent life.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what you were also, what I was hearing you say was that it's not just nice to take care of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
When you don't, it's a violent stuff.
Right.
Yeah. And that's a hard one to, whether it's to your children. And I remember times when I was so crazy, and that was a violence to my kids, because I wasn't having Sabbath time. and wasn't inhaling and exhaling, and wasn't taking time apart.
Thomas Merton has this great quotation about the violence that liberal activists fighting for justice due to themselves and therefore the world by this relentless work and believing if they aren't working all the time, you know, all hell will break loose. They are the thin line between just, you know, God's kingdom or not, forgetting the God part of it.
What I partly hear you pushing or turning us towards is when we're thinking about justice, we almost inevitably start thinking about love. They're so intricately interrelated. And I have another chapter about the practice of giving unto others, but what about myself is the title of it. And it does sort of challenge, you're challenging, I think, a way that the Christian tradition has truncated love into being self-sacrificial to the point that there's no place for the self. And in fact, Luther is partly to blame here. He really did see self-love as mutually exclusive with love of others. And I think we're learning that they're more interrelated than Luther understood, that they support each other. And that takes me all the way back to the quick comment about that you do get back, even when you're really giving to children. There are ways in which they are giving back, and that sacrifice, there's no such thing as a pure self-sacrificial act in some respects, and that making the space, whether it's institute or rest time, that models to your children that everyone needs care, including myself, is really an important piece of doing justice internal to the family. I know we're close to the end. We really should end. I also want to pick up a phrase that you use, that it really pulls at your heartstrings to help children learn they're not the center of the universe, because there's something, it also pulls at our parental heartstrings. And this culture, if anything, has really made space for parents to overindulge. Their children are it's all about their children. It's all about my child being the best. That was a constant test for me, it seemed to me, of Christian discipline, to sit in the basketball stands and not think it's all about my son, he should be on the floor. Or to sit in the football stands and realize, no, this is not all about, I mean, I think our culture builds in ways in which both our children think they're the center, and then we tend to be equally drawn into assuming that it's all about our children, their best education. And sometimes I found myself thinking, no, you know, my kids can get the best education, but if all the children in the world don't get a good education, then it's all for naught. It's about all of God's children. And I really think that is, when it comes to doing faith or Christian spirituality, that's where we differ from and most self-help spirituality books.
Kind of countercultural in our society to think about the whole as opposed to the individual.
Well, and that, maybe that's a good note to end on, because some of the time people have come thinking about their ministry, their churches, and we need support. Churches can give us that. If you're going to be countercultural, then you need community. And when I go back, this family that moved into the Detroit neighborhood that was poor didn't do that alone. Did it with the close, collegial work of Catholic Charities in their presence. And I think it is, this in some ways, that's why this is maybe the hardest chapter in the book, is that you can't do this alone. And you do make lots of compromises and failures, and you hope the community will carry us along.
When we bring our children to the font, we do it in the center of the community. And I take it very seriously when another baby is baptized, that I am supposed to be involved, and I expect that of the community. It's very, you know, private baptism is really incongruous because it's grafting into the community of Christ.
Yeah, that we carry the tasks together.
What you were saying about in the that you were saying you don't generally have grandparents because the congregation assumes that role.
Yeah, but we do a really lousy job of reminding them of that and helping sacramentalize it. I'm thinking, we need to start anointing a whole congregation when we have baptisms. I was thinking we'd need to do that with the parents, some sort of blessing of
just
parents.
Turn on the fire sprinklers or something.
Something.
Yeah, everybody's in there.
Yep.
At a baptism, everybody gets wet.
Yeah, that's it.
Well, in some ways, it's calling on the community to support the family as a whole,
yes,
in addition to the young one being brought into the family.
Right.
And the challenge to that is that in the community, if you reprimand, or, you know, I mean, like in my neighborhood, you take on somebody else's child, and then they're like, but that's my kid, you're not supposed to say anything to them. You know,
well, that's my center of the universe.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so I mean, when you're in a church, that's not so much a challenge, but then you take that out. You know, if my kid's doing something wrong and I'm not right there, I told another kid I knew his name, I don't really know his parent, I'm like, get off the truck, I don't really think you're supposed to be climbing on the stuff they just brought in.
but again, I think...
And he got down, and, you know, I didn't have any qualms about doing that here at all, you know.
I think it is slightly countercultural. This U.S. way of sort of my family, my individual responsibility, and I think churches contest that in this community models, that it is sort of the overused, but nonetheless, it takes a village, that raising children really is, and I think that's the Christian understanding of formation for children, that it is something embodied through the community and depends upon it. So, I said earlier in the week that this book is really hoping to lighten the load, to not add one more thing on your list that you think, okay, now I have to do justice, you know, but to look at places you are already doing justice. Be more intentional, find more support, find ways to do it in richer ways. This is the one chapter that's the hardest to say, you know, this book is not about laying on more weight, it's to say blessings as you, you know, work towards embodying this with each other.
And I'm sitting here listening to all this from the perspective of being a grandparent.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. It works so well. I mean, I'm at a place in my life that I know my son and his wife are not,
mm-hmm.
you know, because they're busy getting the family going. But as a grandparent, I can do that, a lot of what we're talking about, and I do with my grandson. And so it's like, where are the grandparents?
Yes.
Do you need some more grandkids?
Grandparents and... this is a word that has emerged out of the African-American tradition and women who've been writing and thinking, but I love this word, other mothers.
Mm-hmm.
And we really, you know, churches can model other mothering. It is part of the Christian understanding of adoption and care. And so grandparents, it takes a lot more than just one or two parents, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, the grandparent roles to really be... privilege to. Well, I need to release. We probably could stay, but I'm going to let you go.